Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news, as well as local guests for homegrown perspectives and connections to local resources. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily, in a healthy community, on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 155. It's Monday, March 14th. I'm recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Well, folks, what would seem to be one of the easiest things in public health would be to count dead bodies. And while that may be not too difficult, ascertaining what the cause of death is a little more tricky. And particularly when you got a new diagnosis like COVID-19 and in the middle of a pandemic. To get to that, this from MedPage Today. COVID's death toll 3 times worse than official counts. The global COVID-19 death toll may be 3 times higher than official tallies, according to a systematic analysis of excess mortality during the pandemic. From January 1, 2020 to December 31, 2021, global deaths directly attributed to COVID-19 reached 5.9 million. Yet, estimates put excess deaths during this period at a staggering 8.2 million, the COVID excess mortality collaborators report in The Lancet. The excess mortality rate in the U.S., 179 per 100,000, was about on par with Brazil at 187 per 100,000, the study found. Overall, the global rate of estimated excess mortality from COVID-19 was 120 deaths per 100,000, with 21 countries exceeding 300 excess deaths per 100,000. The highest estimated excess mortality rate from COVID was in Bolivia at 735 deaths per 100,000. Followed by Bulgaria, Eswatini, North Macedonia, and Lesotho. Iceland had the lowest excess mortality rate at a negative 48 per 100,000. Australia, Singapore, New Zealand, and Taiwan also had negative excess mortality rates. Now that's one of those weird jargony things, having a negative excess. So what that means is that Iceland, Australia, Singapore, New Zealand, and Taiwan actually had less expected deaths during the pandemic than they would have otherwise. So some people fared pretty fairly well in some countries. Okay, folks, well, as masks are coming off in many people in many places, we have additional evidence that masking works. Here's a few stories to that effect. First up, from the National Institutes of Health. Mandatory masking in schools reduced COVID-19 cases during Delta surge. In the current study, most COVID-19 cases among students and staff were acquired from the community, and approximately 10% of cases were acquired within school. The researchers found that for every 100 community-acquired cases, school districts with mandatory masking had approximately 7 cases of in-school infections, while optionally masked districts had 26 cases of in-school infections. In other words, school districts with optional masking had approximately 3.6 times the rate of in-school COVID-19 cases when compared to schools with mandatory masking. These data also show that mandatory masking was associated with a 72% reduction of in-school COVID-19 cases compared to districts with optional masking. Okay, to unpack this a little bit, this has been kind of confusing, the whole school issue. Because you have two things. Students obviously spend a lot of their life outside of school. So this would be community-acquired cases where they would acquire COVID-19 outside the community. And then you can look specifically for the ones, cases that are actually transmitted within the school. So if you're looking at masking within a school, the most appropriate comparison is, are you preventing COVID-19 transmission within the school? And for staff and students, it looked like having a mandatory masking policy was about 3.5 times less COVID-19 cases than those that had an optional masking. So that's actually very effective. I'd call highly effective. Now, the thing that's confusing is a lot of people say, oh, well, if you don't have masking in schools, it's not going to affect the community that much. And there's a little bit of truth to that, because most of the cases among staff and students are actually acquired in the community, and actually the rather large proportion of those. Basically, if you look at the protection that masking offers within schools versus those that just have optional masking, you're going, for school staff and student, you're going to get 18% more total community infections if you have a school masking policy that's optional. So that's 18% more total infections among school staff and students, not the entire population. But it'll protect that population, prevent about 1 in 5 cases of COVID. Not insignificant, but it doesn't seem quite as drastic as the data that's looking specifically at the masking policy preventing COVID within the school. I mean, a 3.6 times reduction in cases is rather large. So, of course, it can be confusing, but when you unpack it, I think this shows that a mandatory masking versus optional masking is highly effective. And in similar data from Medical Express, mask mandates worked in schools last fall, says CDC study. In a study released by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, researchers examined public school districts in Arkansas from August to October and found that those with mask requirements had 23% lower rates of infection among students and staff members than districts without mandates. So that was a slightly better protection than that other study, but in the similar ballpark, corroborating that data. Okay, well, looking society-wide rather than just in schools, we have this about masking from Science Daily. Continuing face mask use could save U.S. billions of dollars, study suggests. In recent weeks, many locations in the U.S. have been lifting indoor face mask requirements. Despite less than 70% of the population being fully vaccinated against COVID-19 and less than 45% having received a booster. A new study published in Lancet Public Health suggests that consistently maintaining face mask use until and even 2 to 10 weeks beyond reaching various vaccination coverage thresholds, either 70 or 90% of people fully vaccinated, could not only prevent a substantial number of cases, hospitalizations, and deaths, but also end up saving businesses, the healthcare system, insurance companies, taxpayers, and others money. Results from the study's computer simulation model of the entire U.S. suggest that when the reproductive number of the virus, that is how contagious and infectious the variant is 5, corresponding to the Delta variant, and 80% of the population is fully vaccinated by May 1st, maintaining face mask use until then could save a total of $2.9 billion in direct medical costs, which would benefit the healthcare system, insurance companies, and anyone else paying for healthcare. It could save a total of $20 billion in productivity losses that would benefit employers and taxpayers. Notice that's about 7 times what the direct medical care costs are. If the same coverage, 80% is reached by July 1st, rather than the first model, which was May 1st, maintaining face mask use until then could save a total of $3.3 billion in direct medical costs and over $23 billion in productivity losses. All of this suggests that it would be worthwhile for employers, governments, and insurance companies to invest into providing face masks and maintaining their use until 2 to 10 weeks after different target vaccination coverages have been reached. Face masks could offer even greater benefits with more infectious variants, such as Omicron and its subvariant BA2. For example, results from the model suggest that when the reproductive number is 10, corresponding to the Omicron variant, maintaining face masks would avert $49.5 billion in societal costs. That's direct medical costs and productivity losses, as well as face mask costs. $5.2 billion in direct medical costs, almost $50 billion in productivity losses, and 18 million cases compared to no mask use if 70% of the U.S. was fully vaccinated by March 1st. Vaccines save lives, but alone are not enough to get our society to a point where we can safely be free of COVID-19 requirements like face mask use yet, said Dr. Peter Hotez, professor and dean of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine. Of note, the study looked at maintaining the level of face mask use that was seen in the U.S. in March to July 2020, when many medical-grade face masks were not as readily available to the general public. Further increasing face mask use or using more effective masks such as N95 could further increase the cost savings. For example, scenarios are revealing that increasing face mask use by 10% above the face mask use level seen in March to July of 2020 could increase the cost savings in cases, hospitalizations, and deaths averted by up to 20%. Moreover, anything that further increases COVID-19 coronavirus's infectiousness, such as variants or subvariants, decreases in vaccine effectiveness, either through waning immunity, lack of boosters, or emerging variants, or increases social interactions, only increases the face mask value. The study highlights the importance and value of implementing multi-layer interventions such as continuing to use face masks while vaccinating and social distancing. The study's results suggest that it could be economically worthwhile for businesses to provide and encourage face mask use. So the bottom line is, when you're looking nationwide, it still makes sense to mask up as a nation. It is cost effective from both direct medical productivity loss and human suffering. Unless, of course, you're one of those people where the greatest human suffering you have in your life is wearing a face mask. Okay, well, most people are well aware of the political divide that COVID-19 has manifested in our country. And here's an interesting Axios poll that gets at that, breaks it down even a little bit more. Media habits define the COVID culture war. The key factor determining how Americans have handled COVID-19, more than race, education, or even political affiliation, is where they get their news, according to an analysis of 2 years of data from our Axios Ipsos Coronavirus Index. Why it matters. Partisan divisions weaken U.S. leaders' ability to deal with such existential crises, and the modern media landscape feeds that cycle. By the numbers, in March 2020, when everything changed, roughly 9 in 10 Americans, regardless of their preferred media outlet, said they trusted the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. Within weeks, though, that trust was plunging among Americans who mostly watch Fox News or other conservative outlets, as well as those who cited no source. By the end of the last month, just 16% of those who said they get most of their news from Fox or other conservative outlets still say they trust the CDC, compared to 77% of those who favor network news and major national newspapers, and 87% of those who primarily watch CNN or MSNBC. People who primarily got their news from Fox or other conservative media outlets were also more likely to be unvaccinated and to report that they had tested positive for COVID-19 at some point during the pandemic. By the end of last month, 77% of respondents overall said they'd been at least partially vaccinated. For Republicans and for watchers of Fox and other conservative media, it was about 10 percentage points lower. The highest vaccination rates among respondents were Democrats at 87%, and those whose primary news sources were network TV or major national newspapers, 86%. The lowest vaccination rate, 57%, was among those saying they had no primary source of news. So, apparently, having no primary source of news, not paying attention at all, actually led to lower vaccination rates than even having a bad source of news through Fox or other conservative outlets. Well, you can fool some of the people some of the time and all the people some of the time. If you're told lies over and over from what seems to be a trusted source, that is not good. How can we tell the difference? That's part of what this show, Just for the Health of It, wants to do for you. And with that, this. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, folks, well, COVID-19 has been receding, which is good news, but a question you may still have is, what may the next few months bring? And I want to give you a select sampling of the report from your local epidemiologist.substack.com. And this is the recent state of affairs in Europe and the U.S. Cases in Europe are increasing. Germany is the case leader, followed by the Netherlands, Russia, and France. In the UK, cases have increased 30% in the past week. Austria, Portugal, Greece, and Switzerland are also seeing increasing trends. Collectively, the uptick could be driven by behavior. Countries are opening and people are really wanting to put COVID behind them, regardless of whether the virus is ready for that. For example, in the UK, all mitigation measures have been removed, including self-isolation. Mainly, though, I think the uptick in European cases is driven by BA2, the sister sublineage of Omicron. We typically see the impact of variants once they account for about 50% of cases. Germany and the UK just recently reached this threshold. Switzerland and Netherlands are close. Denmark, which has been slammed with cases over the past month, has been well past 50% for a while. Typically, hospitalizations lag cases by 3 to 4 weeks, but they too are already increasing in some parts of Europe, like the UK. The fact that hospitalizations are not lagged in the UK may be explained by their high test positivity rate of over 10%. People are just not testing anymore, and thus hospitalizations are sneaking up. So what does this all mean for the US? Throughout the pandemic, the US has lagged Europe trends by a few weeks. Right now, only about 10% of our cases are due to BA2. But once this starts reaching the 50% threshold, we can expect cases to start increasing. This, combined with removed mitigation measures, should land us with an uptick in April or May. The height of the uptick and the implication of such is dependent on a few things. BA1, the original Omicron's reach. Scientists estimated that Omicron reached about 45% of Americans. Scientific studies have found reinfection of BA2 after BA1 is very rare, which is good. So this leaves about 55% of Americans still susceptible to Omicron infection, especially if these 55% are people who are not boosted. The height of the uptick will also be dependent on how well CDC's new framework works and if people are willing to change behaviors, like wearing a mask again. All eyes are on wastewater surveillance. In the past 15 days, 34% of wastewater sites on the CDC dashboard have reported an increase in viral detection. If these sites continue to increase and/or more sites report upticks, then it's a great early signal of where cases may be going in the U.S. And another note on that, the whole new CDC metrics for masking. One researcher pointed out that if we follow this, these metrics when cases are going up, and that's the real test. If they're going down, there tends to be a trend. So it's good for unmasking, but is it good for remasking? And according to their calculations, by using the new CDC metrics for masking, it will basically hold us to equivalent of 1,000 deaths per day nationally, which would solidly put it in the third leading cause of death. So by my judgment, that's not a very sensitive indicator. And because it relies a lot on hospitalization data, basically by the time the CDC even flips the switch for recommending indoor masking, it's already well into a surge. And of course, then that recommendation has to be heeded by state and local authorities and individual citizens. Okay, well, let's take a look at the local COVID-19 update then. We're still seeing cases going down a bit, although it seems to be leveling off. Cases dropped to 40 identified cases per day on average, and this has kind of gone up and down the last couple weeks. It was 41 a couple weeks ago. It was 51 last week. Probably will be hanging around that territory. It's hard to say. Of course, this is much lower than what we were a couple months ago, even a few weeks ago. Testing positivity rates are low and continue to decline. The positivity rate in Lucas County was only 2.1%. Way to go. Not the lowest we've been, but it's getting there. And that's a drop from 2.5% from the week before. Ohio's a little higher at 2.8% and dropped from 3.6% the week before. And the U.S. as a whole, similar, down to 2.7% from 3.3% the week before. So still going the right direction. Nursing home cases dropped again, down to 57 active cases in long-term care facilities in Lucas County, with 34 residents and 23 staff with reported active COVID-19 cases. And good news, we had no additional deaths reported for long-term care residents. Okay, University of Toledo continues to show good signs, and UT is kind of our canary in the coal mine, is one of the few areas where we've got community surveillance going on in kind of a standardized way, so we can get an idea of what's going on in the larger community, in as much as university students are representative of the larger community. But they only had 9 identified cases, down from 13 the week before, which was half of what it was the week before that. So great news there. In fact, their surveillance testing, when they test hundreds of people, only identified one positive, and they didn't even do a percent, because when you only get one positive, it's really not good statistics. Try to do that. But again, the right direction. Hospitalizations in Lucas County and Ohio are still dropping steadily. Deaths nationally are dropping steadily, and they're down to around 1,300 per day. But I might remind you, this is still the number 3 leading cause of the death in the U.S. today. And in the last 2 weeks, the most recent reporting for Lucas County had 35 deaths. So we're still getting a few deaths a day. Now, okay, so that's 1,300 per day, which is really high. Last July 4th, the Independence Day that Biden was talking up as our freedom from COVID-19, around that point, we had about 200 deaths per day. And if you had 200 deaths per day average throughout the year, that annualized, that would be 72,000 deaths a year. That would be like a terribly deadly flu season, except, of course, that was in the middle of the summer. So even the lowest point we've got for deaths in this pandemic is like a terribly deadly flu season. And it's going to be probably a couple months or more, assuming that's a trajectory that we have continues on a downward, steadily dropping trend. We ain't out of this yet. Well, folks, you're listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. This is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. Well, my friends, while public health definitely deals with crises, the stuff of everyday living in public health is a long game of anonymous work in trying to make sure that bad things don't happen. And that, of course, puts those bad things out of the consciousness if public health actually has success. And this sets up one of the biggest conundrums in public health. And getting at that, this story from Stat News. Haven't we learned anything? Experts warn of disastrous consequences if pandemic funding dries up. The failure of Congress last week to approve additional pandemic response funding could have potentially devastating consequences, prominent COVID-19 experts are warning, leaving the federal government unable to invest in more therapeutics, vaccines, testing, and other initiatives. The impasse has left several prominent experts distressed that political posturing could leave the United States stuck again in a cycle of underpreparedness. Several experts who spoke with Stat said it's not entirely certain a new variant could be coming or when it could emerge or how severe it could be, but if lawmakers wait to find out, it's going to be too late. It would be going out and purchasing fire trucks the moment the 9/11 call comes into the station, said Michael Osterholm, a prominent epidemiologist at the University of Minnesota and former COVID-19 advisor to President Biden. To not fully fund these programs, you are playing with an infectious disease fire, and it will burn you. In the process, unfortunately, people will unnecessarily have to die, Osterholm said. The federal government promised to buy 20 million courses of Pfizer's antiviral drug, but has only actually contracted for less than 11 million of those courses. Available supply could wane as other countries place orders, a Biden administration official said. The federal supply of monoclonal antibody treatments, which are a favorite tool of some Republican governors, could run out in early May without further funding. Testing capacity could potentially decline by 50% without further federal investment, an administration official said, as testing demand is declining as the Omicron surge subsides. Ramping back up to current levels could take 6 months, and turnaround times would be longer. There you go. It's easier to ramp down than it is to ramp up. Even though vaccine supply is ample right now, it's possible purchases will need to be made this spring to prepare for a future authorization of vaccines for children younger than age 5, which would be administered in a specialized dose and delivered to thousands of providers. The looming possibility of additional booster shots for immunocompromised patients could further strain the existing supply. Only 65% of the U.S. population is fully vaccinated, according to the CDC, and of the fully vaccinated, only 44% have received their booster shot. A program that pays hospitals and clinics for testing and COVID-19 treatment for people without insurance will run out of funds soon. It's unclear how much of these costs would be transferred to patients if providers don't have the option to bill the federal government for these expenses. Okay, well, that's what we're facing in this country, a first world country, but globally, the situation is similar in many ways. This from Politico. Is COVID over? No, but global health funders are moving on. As a way of transitioning out of the emergency phase of COVID-19, governments and multilateral organizations are beginning to release massive budget requests for pandemic preparedness. In just the last few weeks, the Biden administration has laid out a new plan for preparedness. Lawmakers on Capitol Hill have launched a new bill outlining funding priorities for domestic and international preparation, and the G20 is calling for $75 billion in international public funding to address gaps in pandemic prevention and preparedness. Health advocates and officials leading the race to vaccinate the world have long feared the money they secured would disappear as soon as wealthy countries vaccinated the majority of their populations. Now, they see those dollars potentially flowing to preparedness rather than efforts to end the COVID-19 pandemic. We've spent $26 trillion in fighting the pandemic. Again, that's with a T. We've spent $25 trillion in fighting the pandemic. We are not ready to spend $75 billion for starting prevention now. That is wrong, referring to a recommendation a panel of experts made to the G20 earlier this year. Where is the political will? One of the challenges is that a pandemic is often treated as a health crisis, and as it relates to low and middle-income countries, it's dealt as a development problem. We need to understand pandemics as a security threat. If you view it as a security threat, then a lot of the trade-offs, do we focus on health system strengthening or pandemic preparedness, fall away because you are taking pandemic preparedness out of a fixed health budget or development budget. The budgeting discussion, how to continue to put up money for COVID efforts while at the same time providing funds for preparedness, is one that has consumed lawmakers on Capitol Hill and Biden administration officials. In the past week, the administration has requested from Congress a small fraction, less than $5 billion of what is needed by USAID in 2022 to help put shots into arms in developing countries. In its official request, the administration stressed that it would reassess the funding situation later in the year and would find alternative ways to ramp up its support for the global COVID fight if needed. There's much more work to be done in ensuring lower and middle-income countries have the doses they need and that they have the resources on the ground to distribute them, said Kate O'Brien, the World Health Organization's immunization director. Part of the problem in getting shots into arms in developing countries is that not enough resources have been dedicated to helping countries obtain the infrastructure and medical staffing they need to run widespread vaccine campaigns. USAID, in coordination with COVAX, is prioritizing helping countries with weaker health systems develop plans to ramp up vaccination rates in 2022. There are still 30 countries that have vaccination levels below 10%. As global health organizations are trying to hold on their COVID-19 funding and continue to help protect vulnerable populations and simultaneously prepare for the next pandemic, they're also trying to revamp their existing programming. The intense focus on COVID-19 over the past 2 years has reversed progress on HIV, tuberculosis, malaria, and immunization campaigns, global health experts say. The Global Fund announced recently that the world needs $18 billion to get back on track with that programming, while at the same time fighting COVID-19 and preparing for the next pandemic. And again, remind you that the world has spent trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars on COVID-19 in the wake of the pandemic. And here we just need $18 billion to get back on track. Oh my goodness. It's like we're all trying to walk and chew gum at the same time, one global health advocate working in Washington told me. It's a catchphrase that many use in describing the dichotomy between continuing to focus on ramping up COVID-19 vaccines and also preparing for the next pandemic. Okay, well, coming back to the U.S. is another good example of one of those other initiatives that needs attention and resources. So how are we doing? This from Politico. CDC wants to monitor poop. States aren't all on board. Wastewater surveillance gained popularity during the pandemic as state and local health officials demonstrated how they could detect the coronavirus in their community sewage systems before residents developed symptoms. There's just one problem with the Biden administration's plan to monitor the nation's sewage in the hopes of preventing the next pandemic. Many states are not yet on board. If you enjoyed the way this pandemic worked, you can expect to have that again, said Ted Smith, the director of the Center for Healthy Air, Water, and Soil at the University of Louisville's Environmental Institute. That's what's at stake here. The hope was to build a system that could identify coming COVID case surges and detect new variants. And moving forward, it could pick out other public health threats, such as growing resistance to popular antibiotics, upticks in opioid use, or the appearance of a virus that could cause the next pandemic. But 18 months since the effort began, only a dozen states, including Ohio, are routinely submitting data to the system, according to the CDC. Even then, the information from some of those states is thin. California, which has 39 million people, has 23 collection sites, most of them clustered in the Bay Area. More than half of New York City's 60 sampling sites have no recent data on the dashboard, meaning the CDC doesn't have at least two data points from the last 15 days to calculate a percentage change in viral concentration. The danger for public health decision makers is assuming that a national wastewater monitoring system is fully prepped and ready, when in fact it's still a patchwork system that risks falling apart without sustained funding and participation. Without permanent funding, some wastewater scientists worry the opportunity to establish a national wastewater system will wash away. Well, folks, whether we like it or not, in this case, public health deserves to be in the toilet. But alas, there are more creative ways to do surveillance, and here's one from Bloomberg News. The humble cough drop could be used to map Omicron spread. As governments around the world start to limit testing for COVID-19, the humble throat drop may become a gauge of how quickly Omicron is spreading. Sales of medicated lozenges and gargles, cough suppressants, and over-the-counter pain relief medications have soared so high the products are often in short supply around the world, according to manufacturers and sellers. The trend has emerged even in countries where official testing numbers appear to show that active cases are falling. So, being creative can be a solution to some of these sticky problems. Okay, and speaking of creative, here's a story about a program right here in Ohio, in Cincinnati, that gets at the social determinants of health. There's a wide range of things that classify as public health. This from Medical Express. Providing legal advocacy reduces hospital admissions by 38%. Ever since pushing a large landlord in Cincinnati to correct toxic housing conditions in 2009, clinicians at Cincinnati Children's Hospital have had powerful anecdotal evidence that a long-running partnership with the Legal Aid Society of Greater Cincinnati was making real improvement in child health outcomes. Now they have a large body of data to prove it. In a study published in Health Affairs, researchers examined thousands of cases to demonstrate how the Child Help Program serving southwestern Ohio has resulted in sharp reductions in hospital admissions for children during the year following a referral to the program. If this were a pill that demonstrated a 38% reduction across so many kids in terms of hospitalizations, every pharmaceutical company in the country would be going after it, and every healthcare payer would be figuring how to cover it, said Robert Kahn, MD, MPH, Associate Chair of Community Health at Cincinnati Children's and the University of Cincinnati, and a co-author of the study. Many cases involve investigating housing conditions when a child winds up needing emergency care for asthma exacerbations. Other common situations include contesting eviction notices that can leave sick children homeless, representing families tangled in public benefit disputes, such as unlawful denials or delays in programs like SNAP or WIC, and resolving conflicts with schools when disagreements arise over disability accommodations. Overall, the cases can be as unique as the children involved. This is a terrific study, said Laura Gottlieb, a professor at the University of California, San Francisco, and founding co-director of the Social Interventions Research and Evaluation Network, a national research network that studies healthcare strategies to improve social conditions. This work could only be done in a place like Cincinnati Children's that has had such a long-term dual commitment to addressing families' social, legal, and medical needs, and to rigorously evaluating their programs. The study adds substantively to the literature in the area, in this case demonstrating that a strong medical-legal partnership can contribute to decreasing costly and avoidable health care utilization in children. Yes, folks, legal justice is a public health issue. And large, seemingly amorphous to some people, issues can be large public health issues. Here's a quick one from Science Daily. Communities with higher levels of racial prejudice have worse health outcomes. People who live in communities with higher levels of racial prejudice have worse health outcomes, including more heart disease and mental health problems and higher overall mortality rates, according to research published by the American Psychological Association. Yep, racism kills. And as the COVID-19 pandemic seems to be receding here in the U.S., we still have this from NBC News. Americans are besieged by stress, poll finds. Financial woes coupled with a barrage of horrifying scenes from Ukraine as Russia continues its invasion have pushed the majority of Americans to unprecedented levels of stress, according to a new report from the American Psychological Association. According to the results, 87% of those surveyed cited rising costs of everyday items such as groceries and gas as a significant source of stress. The same high percentage said their mental health was greatly affected by what has felt like a constant stream of crises without a break over the last 2 years. And 84% said the Russian invasion of Ukraine is terrifying to watch. We don't usually see 80% of people telling us that a particular stressor is stressful for that many individuals. 65% said they were stressed about money and the economy, the highest percentage recorded since 2015. 80% of respondents said they were concerned about potential retaliation from Russia, either through cyber attacks or nuclear threats. And 69% said they feared they were witnessing the beginning stages of what could be World War III. Beyond pinpointing the sources of stress for Americans, the poll also delved into how that stress impacted their physical health. Nearly a quarter of respondents said they have tried to cope with pandemic stress by drinking more alcohol, and 58% had undesired weight fluctuations, either gaining or losing more weight than they wanted. More than 70% of parents said they were fearful that the pandemic has impacted kids' social, academic, and emotional development, and 68% of parents said they are concerned about children's cognitive and physical development. Among parents of teenagers, 65% said they felt their children could have benefited from seeing a counselor or other mental health professional throughout the pandemic. So it looks like living in the U.S. has a lot of stress, but let's take a little jaunt into another community, some indigenous groups in the Bolivian Amazon, where we have this study from Medical Express. Some of the world's lowest rates of dementia found in Amazonian indigenous groups. As scientists around the world seek solutions for Alzheimer's disease, a new study reveals that two indigenous groups in the Bolivian Amazon have among the lowest rates of dementia in the world. An international team of researchers found among older Titsamani and Mosaitan people, only about 1% suffer from dementia. In contrast, 11% of people aged 65 and older living in the United States have dementia, according to the Alzheimer's Association. In the same over 60 groups, the research team diagnosed about 8% of Tisamani and 10% of Mosaitan with mild cognitive impairment, which is typically marked by early stage memory loss or decline of other cognitive ability, such as language or spatial perception. The study's authors pointed out that these rates are more comparable to mild cognitive impairment in high income countries like the U.S. So they do a lot better with the worst dementia, but are similar for mild impairment. The study authors compared their results to a systematic review of 15 studies of indigenous populations in Australia, North America, Guam, and Brazil. That early review found dementia prevalence ranging from 0.5% to 20% among indigenous older adults. The fact that indigenous populations in other parts of the world have high rates of dementia may be due to a higher amount of contact with and adoption of lifestyles of their non-indigenous neighbors. They also face greater risks of diabetes, hypertension, alcohol abuse, obesity, and cardiovascular disease. Well, welcome to the modern world. These dementia risk factors are extremely low among the Tsitsimani and Mositan populations. Prior research published in The Lancet showed that the Tsitsimani people have extraordinarily healthy hearts in older age and the lowest prevalence of coronary atherosclerosis, a disease that shows in the form of fatty deposits inside arteries, of any population known to science. This distinction may be linked to their subsistence lifestyle. Another study published last year in the Journal of Gerontology, led by USC professor Andrea Aramenia, and also a co-author on this new publication, found that the Tsitsimani experience less brain atrophy than their American and European peers. Researchers say, in contrast to the Tsitsimani, lifestyle factors in higher income countries, including lack of physical activity and diets rich in sugar and added fats, contribute to heart disease and may also accelerate brain aging. Aging is the most important known risk factor for Alzheimer's and other dementias. Converging evidence points to low formal education, midlife hypertension and diabetes, cardiovascular disease, physical inactivity, and, most recently, air pollution as the major modifiable risk factors in dementia and Alzheimer's disease. An aging global population, along with the proliferation of these modifiable risk factors, will lead to a tripling of the number of people with dementia worldwide by 2050 to more than 152 million. By working with populations like the Tsitsimani and the Mositan, we can get a better understanding of global human variation and what human health was like in a different environments before industrialization, said Benjamin Trouble, a study co-author. What we do know is the sedentary urban industrial life is quite novel when compared with how our ancestors lived for more than 99% of humanity's existence. And another quick story on dementia, this from Medical Express. These three risk factors may have the biggest impact on dementia cases. Nearly half of all dementia cases in the U.S. may be linked to a dozen modifiable risk factors, most notably high blood pressure, obesity, and physical inactivity, according to new research. The findings suggest a large portion of dementia cases could be prevented, especially among Black and Hispanic adults who had the highest percentage of combined risk factors. Previous research identified 12 modifiable risk factors, which are lower education level, hearing loss, traumatic brain injury, high blood pressure, excessive alcohol consumption, obesity, smoking, depression, social isolation, not getting the recommended amount of physical activity, diabetes, and air pollution. And next up, a story on the connection between physical and mental health is from MedPage Today. Concussions linked to mental health issues in kids. Concussion in kids was associated with an increased risk of mental health problems compared with orthopedic injury, a 10-year retrospective cohort study from Canada found. Among over 400,000 youths aged 5 to 18, those who had a concussion were at a 39% greater risk for mental health problems, a 49% greater risk for self-harm, and a 47% greater risk for psychiatric hospitalization. Yep. Concussions have long-term effects in many cases. Okay, well, let's switch gears and do some environmental health stories. First up from Medical Express, the air quality in your home may be worse than in your office building. A new study from Texas A&M University School of Public Health suggests that air quality inside homes may not stack up against air quality inside office buildings. Air pollution indoors is most often linked to building materials and the activities of people living and working in those buildings. These pollutants include volatile organic compounds from carpet and furniture, paints and other chemicals, as well as fine particulate matter and mold. Prolonged exposure to indoor air pollutants is associated with a wide range of poor health outcomes, from headaches and dry eyes to cardiovascular disease and lung cancer. These outcomes have driven significant work into improving office building indoor air quality. However, the percentage of people working from home has grown dramatically over the past two decades and skyrocketed since the beginning of the COVID-19 pandemic, meaning home indoor air quality can be considered a workplace health issue. Their participants all lived in single-family homes with central air conditioning, and none of the people living in any of the households smoked or worked with hazardous materials. The study found that the fine particulate matter concentrations were significantly higher in the participants' homes than in their offices, and the home levels were greater than the standard for a healthy work environment. The researchers also found that the volatile organic compound concentrations were higher in homes compared to offices. However, those concentrations in both places were well above the limit set by health standards. The majority of employees in the study reported higher frequencies of symptoms while working at home. The findings of this study point to the importance of indoor air quality for people working from home and the need to measure to improve indoor air quality. This could be as simple as opening windows when outdoor air quality allows it, or providing remote workers with air purifiers. Yes, We live in a highly interconnected community. Environmental issues, health issues point that out. This next story from Medical Express does this very well. Almost all kids have tobacco on their hands, even in non-smoking homes. Young children touch everything, carpets, tabletops, toys, clothes, etc., and then touch their mouths and faces. This makes them especially vulnerable to third-hand smoke, the chemical residue from tobacco smoke left behind on dust and on surfaces after someone smokes or vapes. More than 97% of the 504 children in the study had some level of nicotine present on their hands. More surprisingly, more than 95% of children in non-smoking households and home smoke bans still had nicotine on their hands. Importantly, efforts to protect children from tobacco exposure were found to be highly effective in these vulnerable populations. Parental protections like home and car smoking bans drastically reduce the amount of nicotine detected on these children's hands. And this next one, particularly for those of us in the older half of the population, this from the Associated Press. Half of U.S. adults exposed to harmful lead levels as kids. Over 170 million U.S.-born people who were adults in 2015 were exposed to harmful levels of lead as children, a new study estimates. Researchers used blood lead level, census, and leaded gasoline consumption data to examine how widespread early childhood lead exposure was in the country between 1940 and 2015. In a paper published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, they estimated that half of the U.S. adult population in 2015 had been exposed to lead levels surpassing 5 micrograms per deciliter, the CDC's threshold for harmful lead exposure at the time. The scientists also found that 90% of children born in the U.S. between 1950 and 1981 had blood lead levels higher than the CDC threshold, and the researchers found significant impact on cognitive development. On average, early childhood exposure to lead related to a 2.6-point drop in IQ. The researchers only examined lead exposure caused by leaded gasoline, the dominant form of exposure from the 40s to the late 80s, according to data from the U.S. Geological Survey. Leaded gasoline for on-road vehicles was phased out starting in the 70s, then finally banned in 1996. Though the U.S. has implemented tougher regulations to protect Americans from lead poisoning in recent decades, the public health impacts of exposure could last for several decades. Childhood lead exposure is not just here and now. It's going to impact your lifelong health. Early childhood lead exposure is known to have many impacts on cognitive development, but it also increases risk for developing hypertension and heart disease. I think the connection to IQ is larger than we thought, and it's startlingly large, said Ted Schwabe, a researcher at University of Texas Austin, who studies personality psychology and was not part of the new study. The more tragic part is that we keep making the same mistakes again. First it was lead, then it was air pollution. Now it's PFAS chemicals and phthalates, those chemicals used to make plastics more durable, and it keeps going on and on. And on that note, this from Science Daily, respiratory illness increased as far as 60 miles away from flaring of natural gas from oil well. Flaring of natural gas from oil wells appeared to cause an increase of around 11,000 hospital visits for respiratory reasons in North Dakota, up to 60 miles away from oil drilling sites, according to new research. Researchers found evidence of a causal link between natural gas flaring increases in hospital visits for respiratory health. They estimated that a 1% increase in flared natural gas increased the hospitalization rate by 0.75%. The biggest surprise wasn't that flaring caused more people to require hospital visits. It was that people affected by the dirtier air aren't necessarily the ones benefiting from the oil production. We were shocked at how unfair wind is. We found that 50% of the pollution from flaring went to areas that extracted less than 20% of the oil wealth. The people paying the health costs aren't necessarily the same people getting the benefits of drilling. Natural gas is often thought of as a, quote, clean energy, but that's because it is captured and processed when used for electricity or to fuel vehicles. The raw gas released from drilling is contaminated with a wide variety of pollutants. Burning spreads these contaminants far and wide, hurting the health of people that may have nothing to do with the oil. That cost to human health, added to the cost of greenhouse gas emission costs, make flaring even more expensive for the areas surrounding oil extraction. During the time when North Dakota had few restrictions on flaring, the state accounted for 3% of worldwide flaring, more than all but 10 countries on its own. That also means flaring is a continuing issue around the world that is potentially causing millions of people to breathe air polluted by often years-long flames. Okay, let's switch gears to a few healthcare stories. First up from Axios. For-profit hospitals skip less profitable services. This may go under the duh category. Nonprofit and government-owned hospitals are more likely to offer relatively unprofitable services than for-profit hospitals, according to a new study published in Health Affairs. It's a really good long article, but you kind of get the gist. And I just wanted to highlight the fact that profit does not line up with effectiveness in healthcare in the U.S. And rural areas have difficult with healthcare access. This from Bloomberg. Heartland hospitals in U.S. face wipeout with 800 at risk of shutdown. Pummeled by the pandemic, at least 40% of rural U.S. hospitals are in danger of shutting down and leaving millions of people in smaller and less affluent communities without a nearby emergency and critical care facility. That's a conclusion of the Center for Healthcare Quality and Payment Reform, whose recent study sees 500 hospitals at immediate risk for closing within 2 years and more than 300 others at high risk within 5 years. The grim assessment by the Policy Center found the problems spread across the country and that the threats will persist even if the pandemic ends because rising costs are outrunning revenue. Another good reason to have national health care for all people in all places.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure health care for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get health care whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without health care. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
And unfortunately, in the U.S., we often do health care that actually harms people rather than helps them. This is an example of that from Bloomberg News. Trauma from LGBTQ conversion therapy costs U.S. $9 billion annually. In a first-of-its-kind look at the financial impact of LGBTQ conversion therapy in the U.S., new research shows the practice creates an economic burden of $9 billion annually. Researchers said the yearly direct cost of conversion therapy performed on LGBTQ young people totals $650 million, found the study published by medical journal JAMA Pediatrics. Indirectly, conversion therapy costs over $8.5 billion annually due to the expense of treating effects like anxiety, depression, suicide attempts, or substance abuse. And we'll fit in one nutrition story here. Unfortunately, not a good one talking about seniors' diet quality. This from Medical Express. Diet quality decreased for U.S. seniors from 2001 to 2018. From 2001 to 2018, there was a decrease in dietary quality among older adults in the United States, according to a study published in JAMA Network Open. Based on the primary American Heart Association score, there was a significant increase in the proportion of older adults with poor diet quality, from 51% to 61%, and a significant decrease seen in proportion with an intermediate dietary quality, 49% to 39%, while the proportion with ideal diet quality remained stable and low at 0.4% in both 2001 and 2018. Yikes. So over 60% of seniors by the American Heart Association score have poor diet quality, and not even 0.5% of people have ideal diet quality. Yikes. Older adults have become the fastest growing segment of the U.S. population. Specific attention should be focused on their diets, on a diet-related policy to improve their health, the authors write. Okay, well, let's end on a little bit of a better note. This from Very Well Health. World Health Organization guidelines encourage telehealth abortion care. For the first time, the World Health Organization recommends the use of telemedicine for abortion pill prescriptions in its abortion care guidelines. Some healthcare providers say the new guidance reinforces the message that all approved forms of abortion are safe and important. The World Health Organization recommendations confirm that unnecessary regulations placed on abortion care in many settings, including the U.S., do nothing to make abortion safer. Melissa Grant, Chief Operations Officer of FemHealth USA at CareFem, an organization that provides telehealth and in-person abortion care across the United States, said in an email to Very Well. In its new guidance, the WHO stated that the abortion pill prescriptions via mail delivery should be offered as alternatives for in-person appointments and that both options should be prioritized. The organization also emphasized the need to provide patients access to scientifically accurate and clear information, quality medication, referrals for additional support, and contraceptive services after the abortion if requested. Okay, now it's time for the bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I reported on in this episode. And I'll give you the link at the end of the list. Set a new record with 21 this week. First up, Congress weighs permanent daylight savings time in a debate as regular as clockwork. Nearly two-thirds of Americans want to stop shifting their clocks twice a year. And number two, how did this many deaths become normal? A good Atlantic piece about public health and the many problems that we face. Three, ignoring behavioral and social sciences undermines the U.S. response to COVID-19. Caught between scientific reductionism and politicization of everything. In between that is a lot of behavioral and social sciences that public health needs to engage. Four, vaccinating kids has never been easy. A good retrospective on the history of vaccinating kids. Five, there may be a new COVID variant, Deltacron. Here's what you need to know about it. Six, prisons skimp on COVID treatments like Paxlovid, even as Biden plans to flood pharmacies with it. Yeah, like I like to say, like the old terrible Russian joke, we're all equal, just some are more equal than others. And that's also true for people with disabilities. With seven, pandemic medical innovations leave behind people with disabilities. Eight, nurses are waiting months for licenses as hospital staffing shortages spread. Nine, study finds bias in how doctors talk to black and female patients. 10, gaslighting of black medical trainees makes residency something to survive. 11, giving gender-affirming care. Gender dysphoria diagnosis should not be required. 12, seeking to shift costs to Medicare. More employees move retirees to Advantage plans. This is really crazy. An entire company can set up a Medicare Advantage plan just for their employees and have the federal government pick it up. Wow. Hey, smart business. It's going to probably shift a lot of costs to Medicare. 13, maternity wards are shuttering across the U.S. during the pandemic, making giving birth more dangerous in the United States. 14, a look inside the first official safe injection sites in the U.S. And a follow-up to that, a good piece. 15, what is harm reduction? Which is what the safe injection sites are an example of. 16, demand for meat is destroying the Amazon. Smarter choices at the dinner table can go a long way to help. 17, hospitals need to get ahead of regulations on climate change. Yes, hospitals have a large environmental impact. 18, more Latino men are dying by suicide, even as national suicide rates decline. Has a lot to do with Latino men not being willing to access and have access to mental health services. 19, Congress moves to give FDA new powers over synthetic nicotine products, including a youth favorite, Puff Bar e-cigarettes. Yep, those tricky corporations have created synthetic nicotine in order to get around natural nicotine regulations. Hopefully that's coming to a close. 20, Ukrainians face lasting psychological wounds from Russian invasion. Yes, war is a public health issue. And 21, a more personal health issue, particularly for you who are or know somebody who is getting older. Is my memory going or is it just normal aging? Don't try to assess yourself. Rather, enlist a close friend or family member to detect whether you are having a problem. You can read this and all the other stories at toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the John Snow Memorial Studio. John Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need-